It's an uncomfortable feeling to realize that a machine can probably do your job. Last week, a company launched a new podcast service that claims it can synthesize the host's voice and have them read whatever's typed. So I'm familiar with this feeling right now. But for half a century or so, as our habits have changed and our communication methods have evolved and technology has taken over, we have not yet found a better way to gauge people's political opinions than the old-fashioned poll, calling people up, asking them what they think and how they'll vote, and doing it until you have a representative sample. Internet polling has not fared much better. Automated robocalls have not topped it either. And honestly, polls are still mostly accurate, despite what you hear. But what if, as accurate as polls can be, they are still flawed? What if part of that flaw is that you have to actually ask people to take a poll so they know what their opinions are for? And what if, you can probably guess where this is going, you could design a computer program that can find people's real opinions, because you're not doing it by asking them. You're just compiling all the opinions that they share for free every second of every day. And what if you called that program Polly? And what if she was better than the polls? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Max Fawcett is a writer at many publications across Canada. He wrote a piece about Polly for The Walrus. Hi, Max.
Hey, Jordan.
Why don't you start by telling me where the narrative that polls are crap came from? Where did that kind of start?
It's a funny thing because polls, to some degree, have always been crap. I mean, if you think back to the, you know, the famous 1948 American election where they had Dewey defeats Truman on the front page, right? Mm-hmm. This is not a new phenomenon, but I think in the last decade, there have been a number of elections in this country, and then particularly in America in 2016, where people were suddenly awoken to the fact that polls were not a predictive and perfectly accurate tool. I remember I had a bunch of friends who, you know, we were watching the election together in 2016, and you had the New York Times little prediction arrow that traumatized everyone. And And it had, you know, it was pointing to Clinton, and we all thought, okay, the polls are right. And then all of a sudden it swung to Trump, and there was a sort of collective moment of like disbelief of like, how could this have been? Well, you know, we were all told that it was just a matter of her winning by a large number or a small number. And I think that kind of really lit the fire in the public consciousness. You know, there'd been big misses in Canada before. I'm thinking of the Alberta provincial election where Danielle Smith was predicted to be the first non-PC government in 40 years, and she did not come close. It was a, you know, almost a landslide re-election for Alison Redford and the PCs. There was a big miss in BC. There was a miss in Ontario. Even the Quebec election recently, there was a miss. So all these misses start to add up, and I think people quite rightly start to ask questions about whether this is something that can be relied on.
Are there more misses now, or do we just hear about them more because we hear about polls globally and we pay attention to politics globally?
That's an interesting question. So Nate Silver, who's sort of the godfather of the polling industry, he has this blog in America called 538. He's a king of the nerds, and I worship him appropriately because he's a baseball guy. But, you know, he came out with this very fiery piece after 2016 saying basically the polls are fine. They're as right or as wrong as they've ever been. Problem is in the way the media is talking about them and the way the media is representing the level of accuracy. And I have some sympathy for that because, you know, I'm a former journalist, but I'm also a former math teacher. And most journalists don't have a real strong sense of numeracy.
Right. You know, that's where Silver's entire career comes from, the fact that we don't understand what he does.
Exactly. And he does. And then he sort of has built up a brand around bringing journalists on who can explain and understand these things. So I think there's definitely some truth to the fact that the media has a role to play in exaggerating the degree of wrongness in the polls. I think the other part of it is just what was at stake in 2016. An interesting thing is that the polls in 2016 were actually more accurate than they were in 2012 in the presidential election. In terms of the percentages that were predicted in the popular vote and then the result. The problem is that in 2016, they got it wrong. So bit smaller error, but they got the winner wrong. In 2012, they did say Obama was going to win, but they didn't think he was going to win by nearly as much as he did. We're fine with that, I think, as the public. Right. I think what we really want is for them to get the people right. We don't really care if you stick the landing on the percentages. We just want to know that when you say candidate X is going to win, candidate X actually does win.
You began by saying the polls have always been crap. So why are the polls crap? What's wrong with opinion polling, and is it changing?
So it is changing, and I'll get to that in a second. I do want to say I don't think that the polls are necessarily crap, but the polls are imperfect. And all the pollsters I talk to are really clear about emphasizing that look, yeah, we're not magicians. This isn't a physical science where we can, go into a laboratory and measure chemicals or weights or things like that. We're trying to predict how human beings will behave. And we can barely predict how we behave as individuals when we get up in the morning. So to predict how all of us will behave down to a level of precision they poll on is phenomenal, I think. In some respects, it's amazing they can even get in the neighborhood. Part of the problem is that they have, with the media's help to some degree, created a set of expectations that aren't realistic, right? So polling is a competitive industry. It's a business. They're not doing it for fun or for free. They are doing it for fun. They're not doing it for free. And so when they get something right, it's naturally their instinct to brag it up and to go, look at us. We nailed the Ontario election to within one percentage point. And then when the other guys get it right, they brag it up. And so there's this kind of nuclear arms race of bragging where I think it takes people to a place where they expect all the polls to be right all the time. Of course, they never brag up the misses.
Right.
Right? They sweep those under the rug and forget they never existed because it's not good for business and understandable. So there, the dialogue around polling, I think, creates a level of expectation that can't be lived up to. And I think that's what's so interesting about the company Advanced Symbolics and their AI technology, is they're saying we think we can turn this into a scientific operation or a scientific exercise, that we can actually replicate the kinds of results that you get in a scientific trial. Big boast, but it's, in some respects, one that the polling industry has set itself up for.
So tell me what Pauly is.
So Pauly is an algorithm that traces its roots back to Los Alamos and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory there and the Manhattan Project, these really sort of smartest men in the world people. And there was a riff on that algorithm that basically allows the people at Advanced Symbolics to create what's known as a sample. So all polls are built around samples, right? You talk to 1,000 people and it is representative of the whole country, which is kind of amazing. But that is at the heart of polling, is the sample. And the problem with traditional polling is, number one, we don't answer our phones anymore.
Right.
Back in the 80s, back in the 90s, if you got a phone call, you'd answer it. You didn't have caller ID. You didn't have the internet. You probably were a little less busy. So yeah, I'll answer the phone.
No, and now they're calling to clean my air ducts and I won't even pick it up unless I know the name.
We'll barely answer phone calls from our own parents. And so good luck if you're a random polling company trying to get someone's opinion. So, response rates that were in the 15, 20, 25, 30% back in the day have gone down to 6%.
6%.
Which makes it very hard to get the random sample that you need to have an accurate poll, because you want a sample that looks like the country. And it's really hard when no one answers the phones, yeah, right? You get a lot of older people, you get a lot of a certain kind of person, but you don't get young people, you don't tend to get new Canadians. It's not good. And so pollsters, the way they've worked around that is they do what's called weighting, where they basically, if you need to talk to 20 young people and you only get four, well, you just amplify their voice, right?
And make each one of them count for five.
Yeah, you make them count for a little more than they should. And that's where things can get really dicey, because if you talk to only four young people, and let's say those four young people are not like most young people, and you weight up their response, your poll is garbage. And what Advanced Symbolics does is it says, rather than trying to find people, call them, get in touch with them, why don't we go where they are, right? And they're on the internet. It's where all of us are. So they go to Twitter, they go to Instagram, they go to the social media networks, and they just look at what people are saying. And that's where they basically construct their public opinion. So they take their sample, and this is where the algorithm comes in, from people who are on social media, is it generates a very accurate and large sample. And that's the magic of it, is that polling traditionally, you only really talk to about 1,000 people, because beyond that, the way the margin of error, the math behind it works, if you double the number of people you talk to, you're not doubling the accuracy. It's diminishing returns. So pollsters, being business people at the end of the day, they don't want to keep calling people. So they stop at around 1,000, because that's where you get good accuracy and it's not too expensive. Pauly can find 10,000 people. Her sample is so much bigger. And she can look at what those people have said in the past about certain things, because obviously all of our Twitter histories are public to varying degrees. So she has a really good sense of the way you talk about an issue and how it's perhaps changed over time. And that's what she uses to figure out how people are feeling. She doesn't ask questions. That's the really interesting and kind of revolutionary part. There are no questions asked. There are no surveys sent out. It's simply looking at what people have said and how they're talking about it now and drawing certain conclusions around what that means for a question.
Give me some real world examples of things that Pauly has been used for that she got right where maybe traditional polls would have been off.
So the big one is Brexit back in 2016 is a really good example of where she kind of broke from the crowd. Conventional wisdom among most pollsters was that Remain was going to win. It was going to be close, but the Leave campaign didn't have the horses. And it didn't turn out that way, obviously. Mm-hmm. It was very much a traumatic year for polling because you had the Brexit miss, which horrified millions of people in Britain. Then you had the Trump miss that horrified millions of people around the world, but also in America. And she didn't miss. She saw that Leave was actually going to win. And it's interesting. It wasn't that she saw it the whole way. She was with most pollsters for most of the campaign. She thought Remain would win. It would be close, but they would win. And then there was a horrible incident where a Labour member of parliament was assassinated by a right-wing radical. And the Prime Minister, David Cameron, called a halt to the campaign for a few days, said everyone needs to cool off. Let's, more politics. Let's take care of what's important. And when they went back to campaigning and people went back to polling, Pauly noticed that something had shifted. It's interesting. It wasn't that people were talking about things differently. It wasn't that she all of a sudden noticed people who were Remain were now Leave. She noticed a pattern in the way people talked in the past. So whenever a poll would come out that had, Remain leading, it would be followed by a surge in Leave voters. It was sort of like this weird back and forth. And the timing of it was such that the way the election date lined up, that surge lined up perfectly with the voting day. Hmm. And so she figured that out, I don't know how, and said, nope, now Leave's going to win because of the way this is timed up. And I talked to the guy who, created her and is the genius behind it. And he said, look, if the vote had been held a week later, Remain probably would have won because this surge in Leave feeling would have died out the way it had the last two or three times.
Wow. So tell me about where Pauly came from, who made her.
So Pauly is the creation of a guy named Kenton White, who is a mathematician, scientist, genius, very soft-spoken. He's a very gentle but very confident that he has figured something out that the rest of the world needs to pay attention to. So he had started different businesses in this field before and in the late 2000s, he sold his last one. And this was right around when social media was kind of taking off, Twitter and Facebook. And he got really interested in it. He got really interested in this idea of having a window into how millions of people were talking about how they felt, about, any number of issues. And he thought it represented an interesting opportunity to use that to gather information, not in like a Cambridge Analytica creepy way where people's information was being harvested, but just, as a someone who is a data researcher who thinks a lot about these sorts of, mathematical things, just this new data set was so intriguing. And people tend to be a little more honest on social media than they are when a pollster calls them and says, how do you feel about same-sex marriage? Or how do you feel about immigration? Where, people may know that their views are outside the mainstream, and so they won't want to talk about it. A little different on social media.
I'm fascinated by how Pauly would pull real responses out of the social media ether. Like, how do you not end up with parts of this sample, including Russian bots, as the common parlance would take it?
Well, so part of it is that the way, the algorithm that is the engine of Pauly's public opinion research, it throws, accounts and people out of the sample if they don't meet certain criteria. Mm-hmm. If your username is Galactic Defender 62497, you're not getting into her sample because don't really know where you are, where you're from. You could be a bot, all that kind of stuff. So they're very careful. They apply all these different, again, mathematical tests that for the math wonks out there, this is all available in publicly published papers. So if you want to go a mile deep on this, it's there for people. But you know, the Coles Notes version is they apply a bunch of tests to their sample to make sure that the people that are in it are real. They live in the place they say they live in, and they're not there to manipulate or misrepresent their opinions. And because there's so many people on social media, and, you know, again, this is a number that grows every day, their sample gets better and better. That's, you know, one of the interesting sort of disconnects between traditional polling and what Polly does is their sample gets harder to tap into and smaller every year. Hers gets bigger. Their ceiling is her floor, to use a sports metaphor, right? She has a lot of upside. They have a lot of downside.
Isn't there a particular type or types, I guess, of people who discuss politics on social media? We always hear about how divisive the conversation is and how polarized it is on there. So if you're sampling people who discuss politics on social media, are you not just going to get the loudest voices in the room?
You will. And I think one of the interesting things that Kenton said when I talked to him was that's not necessarily a problem. You want people who are engaged and passionate because they're the most likely to vote, number one.
Right.
And they are, you know, the most likely to be more representative of their particular, you know, whatever they represent in the sample than someone who is indifferent. Indifference is hard to model, whereas people who are a little more engaged, you have more certainty about, well, yeah, you know, when they say they're going to do X, they probably are going to do X. You know, they're certainly not at a point yet where their work is totally predictive. They've made mistakes. They whiffed a little bit on, you know, the recent Ontario election where they said the Liberals were going to get shut out and they didn't. And so they've, you know, they calibrate Polly to learn from that mistake. But their work, I think, it's an interesting challenge to the industry. You know, when I talk to people in it about their work, the responses ranged from total skepticism to more sort of careful watching of, yeah, this is something we need to be mindful of. I mean, I think that's the interesting thing about the people who work in the polling industry is they're very curious. You know, like a lot of scientists, they're not ideologues. If there's a better way to do things, they will do it that better way. I think they just need to be shown that it's better. And some of them remain unconvinced at this point.
That was going to be my next question is how do you marry the tenets of traditional polling with new technology that can help it? And is there a way to do that? And would that be better? Or should we just throw out the old way and try to perfect the new?
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I don't think we need to throw out the old way because I think the old way still has value. I think
that's good. It creates a lot of content for us.
Well, I mean, don't get pollsters started about the media taking any poll they can get because it creates content because it does drive a lot of them crazy. In the media, we're so starved for, let's call it low-cost content, that when someone throws you a poll that says something, you know, unexpected, you're probably going to run it, even if you maybe know it's not, you know, a great poll or even if you don't know it's not
Listen, outliers are good for business in many places.
That's true. As long as people are talking about it. And, you know, there's been much internal discussion in the polling industry about what to do about that, right? Mm-hmm. How to get quote-unquote bad actors sort of in line. But it's tricky because it's sort of a prisoner's dilemma where the bad actors aren't really that inclined to cooperate with everyone else because their work's getting picked up and maybe they're getting paid. So, I think the interesting thing that pollsters do is not just ask the questions. They do the analysis. And when I talk to a lot of the veteran pollsters in the industry, they're really clear with me about that. It's not just sending out surveys and collecting results and putting out tables with percentage points in it. It's explaining what it means and drawing those dotted lines between 64% of Canadians care about climate change to this is what this means for the federal election, right? It's providing that analysis function. And that's not really something that an algorithm can do.
Well, what kinds of questions can Polly ask? Because I can imagine, I mean, like you said, she's not asking questions, but what kind of questions can she answer? Traditional polls are great for the horse race questions, but they can also get at a whole bunch of other things pertaining to issues around the race, pertaining to how you would rank issues on your ballot, right? Are you more likely to vote on climate change versus a tax cut, et cetera, et cetera? And can she get into that kind of stuff, or is she analyzing kind of either or, pro, against?
I'm very reticent to say there are things she can't do because I'm fairly sure that people who work there will take that as an opportunity to prove me wrong. But at this point, the what she can do, the why is harder.
Yeah.
Because that's more discursive. It's more of a conversation. It's interesting. They don't really they're not super passionate about public opinion polling around politics over at Advanced Symbolics. They're not, they don't love politics. They do it because it's the best way to prove their concept, right? It's a thing that is very visible, and it's a thing we all understand, and it's also a thing you can measure. I say it's going to be 26% liberal, and it turns out to be 26% liberal. I've shown you my formula works. But where they do much more of their research is, I mean, there's a lot of commercial stuff. You know, corporations want to find out what are people saying and how much do they like our product. Social media, having that sample of people on social media is a very good way to do that. You know, Health Canada, after, you know, a school shooting or something, is there a spike in talk of self-harm or suicide? They worked with Health Canada to kind of get ahead of that, and having that information, they could then dispatch resources to the school districts in question. So, you know, there's some really interesting applications there where it's not just about the horse race. It's about giving policymakers better information in a more timely fashion so they can make better decisions. I think that's great. I think that helps everybody. But, you know, in terms of the why do we vote the way we do stuff, you know, it's interesting. I was talking to David Hurley, who is a, you know, he's very famous liberal pollster, advisor, smart guy all around. And he was sort of saying that in his work, he kind of wants to take a step back from the horse race. Not that he doesn't like it, because, you know, if you're in an election race and you are in a riding where strategic voting is a thing, you need to know. But he wants to know why pollsters are, there's a disconnect between what they're seeing and the populist ferment that's happening underneath. Why are people so angry when the, you know, the top line GDP numbers are pretty good? You know, like all the data we have says things aren't that bad, and all the election results keep saying people are angry, right? Mm-hmm. Angrier than should be kind of the case based on the data. And so he really kind of wants to go back to the ground, he was telling me, and do some more deep listening, kind of more holistic qualitative work rather than kind of continuing to just only focus on the horse race stuff. So I think that's an interesting opportunity for the polling industry and the conventional public opinion research industry is go deeper on the why.
Yeah.
Because that's a place where I don't think AI can necessarily beat you.
Where does Advanced Symbolics see Polly in 5 years from now?
I assume they see her being more accurate, being involved in more markets, covering more subjects, growing her sample. I know they're constantly feeding her new information. So it's, I mean, this is going to be a reference that won't work for some of your listeners, but did you ever watch that movie Short Circuit?
It's not even going to work for me.
No? Okay. It was like a Steve Guttenberg movie in the late 80s, and it was about this military robot that like left the robot factory and then became independent.
Right.
And it was called his like Number 5 was the name of the robot. And they would feed the robot information. He would just go through the book like turn the pages so fast, and he would know all the information. And that's what she does. They will feed her information, you know, studies, they will show her newspapers. They teach her how to recognize humor in tweets. So are people tweeting about self-harm sarcastically, or is it authentic? She's always growing and becoming smarter. And so I kind of don't really want to put a prediction out on what she'll be doing in 5 years, because the thing with AI, and part that's terrifying for a lot of us, is it's kind of limitless in its potential. It can do things that we didn't really think were possible. It puts a lot of people out of work that didn't think they could be put out of work. And so, yeah, I don't know. The sky's the limit, I guess.
That is an appropriately ominous way to end the conversation. Thanks, Max.
Thanks, Jordan.
Max Fawcett, a writer at many places, including The Walrus. That was The Big Story. And if you want more big stories, all of them are at thebigstorypodcast.ca. And all of our tweets are on Twitter at thebigstoryfpn. And if you want to make everybody around here feel real good, head over to Apple or your favorite podcast app, hit subscribe, hit rate, leave a 5-star review. And if you want to find us, we're on that podcast app, any other you got, Apple, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, Downcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.